Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host, with Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy's senior apologist at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Lots of folks on the line, so we will go back straight away to the lines. But I just want to let you know, open forum is for you, whether you're Catholic or not. If you've got a question, maybe it's a very specifically Christian or Catholic question, but maybe it's something more general, a more philosophical or moral question. Maybe it's even a scientific question. You're welcome to call with whatever it is, 888-318-7884. Jimmy, we did mention this last hour, but I just want to mention again, tomorrow, the episode that drops on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is?
Shadow people.
Okay. All right. Those are people who
look like shadows.
Oh, an aptly named population. A whole bunch of folks on the line. Back we go to the phones. Sergio's in Colorado watching on YouTube. Sergio, you there with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Very good. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
My question revolves really around the rosary. So I work really early in the morning, and by the end of the day, I'm kind of really tired. I was trying to do rosaries on nightly, and I would notice that I would kind of start dozing off. So what I started doing instead was listening to a rosary app or to a podcast on my way to work in the morning. And I've just had this kind of itching question where I don't feel like I'm necessarily 100% focusing on that because I'm driving, and whether or not it still counts as a valid rosary.
Well, you don't have to 100% focus on a prayer in order to say a prayer. People's minds wander, and that doesn't invalidate our prayers because God knows our intention. Our intention is to say a prayer, and even if we get distracted in the middle of saying it, God still knows what our intention was. And so it doesn't invalidate our prayers when our minds wander. So I would encourage you not to be scrupulous about this and to just do your best to pray and trust God to recognize the limitations that you're working under.
Sergio?
Yeah, no, thank you guys. And also just thank you both in general. I've really just recently found Catholic Answers Live, and it's so mind-blowingly good, and just the information you guys are giving out is so easy to digest. So thank you guys.
Well, that's thank very you. Nice. Thank you, Sergio. Mind-blowingly good sounds like that should be like on a – we should have that on a banner somewhere.
Yeah. Catholic Answers mind-blowingly, Live. Mind-blowingly good.
I love it. Sergio, you're all right. Thank you very, very much. Let's go to Springfield, Missouri. Nicola in Springfield, Missouri, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Nicola, go ahead with your question.
My question is about St. Paul when he was Saul and he was persecuting the Christians. I wondered what his what gave him authority to arrest people and to put them in jail, to whatever, like he did supervision of the stoning of Stephen. He was from Tarsus. He was trained under Gamaliel. He was a tent maker. But what gave him authority? Was it the Sanhedrin? Was it the Roman government?
Okay. Yeah. So first thing. A couple of clarifications. He was always Saul. He, like a lot of people in the ancient world, had, and even many people today, had more than one name. And which name he used would depend on which community he was with. So Saul or Shaul is a Jewish name, and he would use Saul when he was with Jewish people, which is why we see him using that name in the first part of Acts. And then Paulos is a Roman name that he would use because he was a Roman citizen by birth. He would use Paulos or Paul when he was dealing with Gentiles, which is why once his Gentile ministry begins, Luke switches over in Acts from calling him Saul to calling him Paul. This is not one of those cases where God or somebody changed his name. He had these two names that he would use with different communities. He also wasn't supervising the stoning of Stephen, but Luke says he was present for the stoning of Stephen and approved of the stoning of Stephen. He then went on to persecute Christians, including in other cities, and the authority by which he did that was given to him by the Jewish ruling council, by the Sanhedrin. So it wasn't the Romans who gave him that authority, it was the Jewish authorities who gave it to him, and then he would capture these people and bring them back to Jerusalem for trial.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, but he was trained with theology, with Gamaliel, but like there was just certain people that Sanhedrin gave authority to, like commissioned them to do this, to have the authority to arrest, and is that how
We know they gave this authority to Paul. We don't know how many other people they may have given it to, but we do know they gave it to Paul.
Nicola, thank you very, very much for the question. We get the rare. We can do three questions before the first break, so I'm going for it. Michael in Phoenix, Arizona, watching on YouTube. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, gentlemen. Nice to chat with you guys again.
You too,
hey,
Michael.
Quick question. Thank you. I have a friend. She went from stone cold atheist to now like fire breathing Protestant, and I'm just kind of unhappy. But I'm like, you're getting closer. What is the best way, you know, lovingly, of course, with charity, to kind of just initiate that? Because she's very hostile to Catholicism right now. So what's the best way to go about that?
To help her become less hostile to Catholicism, or to help her become Catholic?
My goal is to, you know, I pray a rosary for her every day, offer rosary and you know, adoration, which I'm heading to in a little bit, and you know, to bring her in to the, you know, the fullness of the truth, to be Catholic. Okay. Right now it's just like, I don't want to talk about it, blah blah, type of thing, you know.
Well, if she's saying she doesn't want to talk about it, you know, then I would say, you know, you need to respect that. It may not be the right time for her to talk about it.
Right.
Now, you may be approaching this subject a little directly, like saying, hey, why don't you become Catholic? That's a little direct. And she might be receptive to an approach that's a little bit less direct. You might say, hey, I'm really glad that you're Protestant and that you believe in God and you believe in Jesus now. I think that's awesome. I know that you have some, you know, some concerns about the Catholic Church, and I understand that, and I'd like you to understand my faith. Even if you're not Catholic, and even if you never become Catholic, I'd love for you to understand the Catholic faith better, and I'd like to have the chance to engage your concerns. So if you tell me what you think is problematic about the Catholic Church, I'd love to have the opportunity to respond. And if I don't have a response to a particular thing, I'll do some research and get back to you. And by taking that kind of, you know, gentler, less direct approach, you may be able to get her in a position where she's more interested in talking about the subject and put things on a kind of less confrontational basis than, you should become Catholic now.
Right.
Michael.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael. I'm going to let that be because I got to head off towards the break. As I'm heading to the break, I want to invite everybody to join us for the Catholic Answers Conference coming up just a month from today. We'll be at the conference. It actually starts on September 22nd, runs through September 25th. It's right here in San Diego. And we got great deals on Hyatt rooms at the Hyatt where the conference is being held, just $169 a night, which for any hotel in September in San Diego is a great deal. So if you'd like to come, we'd love it if you'd come and join us for lots of great conversations about the Eucharist, lots of great talks about the Eucharist, and just a great time. CatholicAnswersConference.com is the place to go to. CatholicAnswersConference.com. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Hi, I'm Father Mitch Paquin. I'm going to be at the EWTN Family Celebration in Phoenix, Arizona. Hope to see you there.
Make your plans now to attend the EWTN Family Celebration October 1st at the Phoenix Convention Center in Phoenix, Arizona. Find out how you can be a part at EWTN.com/family celebration.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum. It's Thursday. Jimmy Akin is here. We're happy to take your call, 888-318-7884. Anonymous is on the line watching on YouTube. Anonymous, are you there with us?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, hi, Anonymous. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. My question is regarding the Sacrament of Reconciliation. And if you go and confess a sin that you're not fully repentant or regretful of committing, but you're sorry for going afoul from God, how does that affect absolution and your redemption?
Okay. So feelings like regret or sorrow are natural to have when we realize we've sinned, but they don't affect the validity of the sacrament. What affects the validity of the sacrament is the choice to return to God and say, yeah, that was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. I acknowledge that. And as long as you've turned your will away from the sin, it doesn't matter what emotions you feel about the sin. So you might still feel tempted, or you might still relish benefits you got, even, you know, as a result of the sin. But as long as that's just emotion, it doesn't affect the validity of the sacrament. What affects the validity of the sacrament is the choice to follow God rather than the sin.
Okay. And in instances, though, where you do fall and recommit the similar sin, I guess, does that go back and show that
No. Because
you should not have been forgiven.
People have sins that are chronic. They may have habits that lead them to fall into sins regularly. And in its documents on confession, the Church acknowledges that in going to confession, a person does not have to promise himself that I'm never going to do this again, because he may foresee, based on past history, I'm probably going to do this again at some point. What is required for validity is that at the moment you're confessing, you have turned your will away from the sin. Even if you foresee you're likely to fall into temptation again in the future and may commit it in the future, that doesn't affect validity, as long as at the moment you're confessing, you say, that was wrong, I don't want to do that, I want God's help not to do that. That's sufficient for validity.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anonymous. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Chicago, Illinois. Dave's in Chicago, Illinois. He's also watching on YouTube. Dave, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, good evening, gentlemen. I am a Catholic revert. And while attempting to, you know, be primarily focused with, you know, just my relationship with Christ, you know, there are issues that come up that I'm, you know, doctrinal issues that I'm trying to learn about and wrestle with. So on the issue of indulgences, does the general authority for indulgences fall under the, you know, what you bind on earth is bound in heaven?
Yes.
Statement?
Yes. The understanding is that indulgences are an intervention of the Church that involves the exercise of the keys of the kingdom, which are by which the Church can bind and loose things. And so, yes, they fall under the general heading of binding and loosing, or the keys of the kingdom.
And it's for temporal punishments.
Correct. So yes. Not eternal punishment. The eternal punishment of a sin is already forgiven before you obtain an indulgence for it.
Through confession. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, there's some famous temporal indulgences, like, you know, in the Battle of Lepanto. And then there are some ones that, you know, if you go to Mass on a saint day, for, you know, the Feast of the Saints for which the church you attend, you get a plenary indulgence. You know, it just seems like that's a huge variance in, you know, requirements.
Well, you can't fight in the Battle of Lepanto, Dave. There's no way that's ever going to happen. So do the other one.
But the other All right, is, like, if it can apply in purgatory, purgatory is for purging, basically purging in, you know, imperfections. How do we get a forgiveness of that process? I mean, that process still seems necessary.
Yeah. So there's some doctrinal development going on currently about exactly what purgatory involves. But according to John Paul II, what purgatory does is heal the disordered desires that we have that would lead us into sin. And those disordered desires can be healed either in a way that involves pain and that might take time, or in a way that does not involve pain and that might be instantaneous. And so when someone is in purgatory and someone in this life obtains an indulgence on their behalf, it's applied to them by way of prayer, so that the person in this life with the church is essentially praying to God to help this person. And I have to be a little careful in how I say this, but in essence, to smooth their entrance into heaven, so that they don't encounter the level of difficulty they would have otherwise. And that's the fundamental principle on which indulgences work. It's essentially praying, God, please make it easier for this person to get past the disordered desires that they have, to heal those desires, either by making them less painful, the healing process less painful, or making it quicker, or something like that. But since we don't know a lot about exactly how purgatory works, we know that it exists, and we know certain basic facts about it, but we don't know the details, and so we have to leave those to God. But in essence, we're asking something like, you know, Lord, please help this other person, or if you're applying it to yourself, please make my process or this other person's process easier, whatever whatever form that easing takes, whether it's a shorter duration or a shorter intensity or something like that. But the end goal is always the same, being freed of those disordered desires so that we can fully enjoy heaven.
And Dave, I will leave it there. Thank you very, very much for the call and for the conversation. Lots of folks on the line, so on we go. Mauro is in Carrizo Springs, Texas, watching on YouTube. Mauro, you there with us?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
All right, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, sir. I met with some missionaries from the LDS Church, and there's a load of questions I could ask you, but I want to address this one. I asked them, can you show me some scripture evidence to support the necessity of the Book of Mormon? And they gave me this passage in Ezekiel 37, the joining of the two sticks.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest. I told them as well. Like I'm not very familiar with the Old Testament, so I was wondering what can we infer from the entirety of the Old Testament about these lost tribes of Israel, and do they have some sort of ground to stand on to say that the Nephites and the Book of Mormon are part of these lost tribes?
Okay, so the question, the way Mormons commonly use this passage is to identify the sticks as the two, as the Bible and the Book of Mormon. And the argument for that is very weak, I have to say, because the passage in Ezekiel 37 interprets the parable for us. The joining of the two sticks is a parable, and it's interpreted for us in the text. It represents the reuniting of the so-called lost tribes with the tribe of Judah and also the tribe of Benjamin, with the two southern tribes. In terms of the claim that the the Nephites or whomever in the New World were descendants of these tribes. Well, we're told in the Old Testament where they went. And where they went was like in an area of Iraq. And if memory serves, it was also one of the areas they went was also in modern Iran. But the Bible says nothing about them going to the New World. And so that's something that is not reported in the Bible. It's something that Mormons have claimed, but it's not something that the Bible actually supports. And you don't need to propose the involvement of lost tribe members or the Book of Mormon in order to understand this parable. Now, there's a question. The parable, in essence, is saying these two groups of people are going to be reunited, and it links their reunification to the Messiah, because it says in verse 24, "My servant David shall be king over them." So in the Messianic age, these groups are going to be reunited. Well, how are they going to be reunited? Are they going to be a political kingdom with the Messiah as a political king, or are they going to be spiritually reunited with the Messiah as a spiritual king over them? Cy Kellett, did Jesus intend to be a political king?
No.
No. So that would suggest to us that this is a spiritual reunification. And so, to my mind, a logical way to understand this prophecy is not in terms of establishing a new political entity where the tribes have reunited in that sense, but they're going to convert to the Christian faith along with other people. And that, in fact, happened. Iraq and Iran, prior to the rise of Islam, became Christian. And so the members of the lost tribes that were living there would have become Christian and would have been spiritually reunited with Jewish Christians in Christ's church. So that's both what the prophecy is referring to and how at least I would see the prophecy being fulfilled. You don't need to appeal to anything going on in the New World in order to explain this prophecy. Also, I did an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on the Lost Tribes a while back. It's episode 14, so very early before we had our modern production values on the show. But if you go to mysterious.fm/14, the numbers 1 and 4, you'll find that episode on the Lost Tribes, and you can listen to that for more background.
Thanks, Mauro. I hope that that's helpful to you. We appreciate the call and the question. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin's our guest, coming right back here to California now. Pace in California, watching on YouTube. You are next, Pace. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey there. I was just wondering, would the current Pope be able to reinstitute the Tridentine Mass as it was rumored John Paul I was going to do?
You mean fully, so that the current rite of Mass is no longer used and the Tridentine one is used in its place?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he could. I mean, it's hypothetically possible. He has the authority to do that. I would think it extremely improbable that the current pontiff would do that, or that any pontiff in the foreseeable future would do that. But they have the authority to do it, and so it's not out of the realm of possibility. I also would be a little cautious about claiming or about the rumor that John Paul I was going to do that. I've heard that rumor too, but I've never seen any good evidence for it. And there are loads of rumors about what every pope will or will not do. And people tend to pick the rumors they like that scratch them where they itch. You know, like if they want to think well of a pope, they'll pick a rumor that, I would like it if the pope did that. And they'll just believe it because they like it. Or if they want to think ill of a pope, they'll pick a rumor that makes the pope look bad and say, ooh, did you hear this rumor? I believe this rumor just because it makes the pope look bad. So I think we have to be really careful about rumors like this, especially in the case of a pontiff like John Paul I, who reigned for a month. I mean, how many plans did he really have after he got elected? How many plans was he really, contemplating as things he might actually do in a pontificate that lasted only 30 days or so. I mean, he was, I'm sure he was still formulating plans at the time he died. And I think it quite unlikely that John Paul I would have both formulated and settled on and definitely decided that he was going to reinstitute the Tridentine Mass in that short a space of time. If he was contemplating it, he would have consulted a lot of people. I find it hard to think that he would have made a definite decision that quickly.
Pace, you can hear the music, so that will do that. But thank you very much for the call and for the question. Whole bunch more folks on the line. From the looks of it, maybe one line open during the break. So there is a chance. Give us a call. 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
Can you defend the Church's teaching on the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist? Do you desire a deeper relationship with our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament? Join us September 22nd through 25th for the annual Catholic Answers Conference in San Diego. This year's theme is the Eucharist, I am with you always. Featuring all the Catholic Answers speakers and special guest Bishop Thomas Papraki, use promo code EARLY to save $50 when you register at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
You bring the topics of conversation.
It's our monthly unscripted show tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
On most of these EWTN stations.
Now let's go back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, spinning the hits. That's one that's called The Groovy Music. We always like to play it on Thursdays, and it always makes me happy when I hear it, and I hope it does for you too. Jimmy Akin's our guest. Our number is 888-318-7884. There's a whole bunch of people on the line with questions. If you've got a question, whether you're Catholic or not, it's very welcome here. 888-318-7884. Going to Indiana. Misty is listening on Catholic Radio Indy. Misty, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. So I am a Protestant, seriously considering becoming Catholic.
Okay.
And I have recently...
Good for you.
Yeah. Thanks. I've recently been doing some deep reading and research, so much as I'm able, on various Catholic doctrines concerning grace and works. And my question is actually regards actual grace. So I was looking at some of the councils and some of their declarations on this issue, and they were saying, many of them had said, that actual grace apparently needs to be present for every single good work to be accomplished or have potentiality or certainly to be meritorious. And so considering the fact that even many non-Christians can do and are motivated indeed for pretty pure motives to do good works, why does actual grace need to be present in every in all of those circumstances.
Okay, so let me ask you a question first. What council is it that you're reading from that said this?
Oh, goodness. I don't have it in front of me right now, unfortunately. I believe it was an article of Trent, as I recall. But again, I don't have exact citations. My apologies.
Okay. I'm not 100% sure that, and I'd like to, ideally, I'd like to be able to see the text because sure. It's my understanding that the, that like in some Protestant and Catholic Jansenist circles, there was a kind of an exaggerated understanding of the necessity of actual grace. So I should clarify for people who don't know what that term means. It's common in theology to distinguish between two different types of grace, actual grace and sanctifying grace. Actual grace is a grace that God gives us to help us do good things. So like becoming a Christian is a good thing. And so we would need God's help to do that. And then when we become a Christian, he gives us sanctifying grace, which makes us holy and unites us with him. So one kind of grace helps us do an action, and the other kind of grace helps us be a certain way. So one, you can think of actual grace as the one that gets us to act. Sanctifying grace is the one that gets us to be holy. Now, my understanding is that there have been, like in the Catholic Jansenist movement, some exaggerated understandings of the necessity of actual grace that would say God has to give you his grace for every little good thing you do. Otherwise, you couldn't do a good thing. And my understanding is that's an exaggerated position. Actual grace is necessary for us to come to God and be saved. That's why we're not Pelagians, because we can't move towards God without his grace. So we do need actual grace to be saved. But I don't know of anything that says we need, and I could be forgetting it, but I don't know of anything that says we need actual grace in order to do a good work. But suppose I'm wrong about that. Suppose it does say that somewhere. Well, I would say that for people who have implicit faith and who are implicitly following God, you know, even if they don't believe in him consciously, they're responding to his grace. And so they're people acting, quote unquote, in good faith, even though their faith isn't explicit, that God is giving them actual grace too. Even though he hasn't yet brought them to become explicitly Christian, he nevertheless is working in their hearts and is helping them do good things. And so I would simply say God's grace is at work in those people too.
Okay. Excellent. Thanks so much.
No problem. By the way, I know the Catholic Encyclopedia, the 1910 version of the Catholic Encyclopedia, has an article on actual grace, and I know it talks about the exaggerated understandings of its necessity. So you might want to check that out.
Okay, maybe I misread. But yeah, thanks for that. Thanks for the clarification. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, we'd love it if you'd keep calling, Misty. You're very welcome here. I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book. He has a little book called The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. If you'd like to hang on, I'd love to send it to you if you're interested in it and you want to call back, and we'll have continue this conversation. We'd really love that. Okay, Misty?
Sure.
All right. Thank you. Let's see, what time? Yeah, Mary in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on 710 AM. Mary, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right. Oops, hang on. I'm trying to get you up.
Okay. No, you got us.
Okay.
Mary, if you could talk directly into the phone, it would help.
Yeah, let me try this again. Oop, I know what I'm doing. I'm hitting the wrong button. There we go. Hitting the wrong button.
You sound like me, Mary. That's how I run the show. We can't have the caller and the host doing that. All right, go ahead. Give them your question.
Well, okay. I have heard repeatedly from different sources that Judas was condemned, damned, however you want to list it, for the act of turning Christ over to be persecuted.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, this sounds kind of weird. Christ knew that he was going to do it. He told him, go do what you got to do. Wasn't he kind of, and this is probably very simplistic, almost like a tool for the prophecy to be fulfilled? And if so, it doesn't sound terrible. It doesn't seem fair. You know, somebody had to do it. It became him. Yeah. And
so to answer the question, it is a common opinion that Judas was damned to hell. And so there are lots of people who believe that. And in favor of that, there is the passage where Jesus says that it, woe to him who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born. And that certainly sounds like the person who betrays the Son of Man is going to go to hell. Because if you go to heaven, well, it's better to be in heaven than to be in hell. And so being born was a good thing. So that, you know, makes it sound like Judas would be damned. But like anything, there's the possibility of repentance, you know. Now, in terms of Judas's predestination, it's just like other forms of predestination that we were talking about earlier in the show today. God's predestination includes a knowledge of the acts that a person will freely choose to do. And you have to make a free choice in order to be morally responsible. And Jesus indicates Judas was morally responsible for his choice, which is why he declared woe unto Judas, because he would be punished for what he did. And punishment implies you had a free choice. Therefore, Judas had a free choice. And therefore, he wasn't simply a tool. God did not compel Judas to do this. God allowed Judas to do this, and the devil influenced Judas to do this, but Judas nevertheless did it by his own free will. And so that's why Judas was responsible and would have gone to hell if he didn't repent. So the question then becomes, did he repent? Well, Matthew says he did. Matthew says he repented and he threw the money back in the temple and then he went and hung himself. Now, suicide itself, if you do it knowingly and deliberately, is a mortal sin. But a lot of people are not doing it as a fully human act. They're overcome by grief or anger at themselves, or they have a mental problem. And so the church consequently doesn't say everybody who commits suicide goes to hell. And so since Matthew said that Judas repented, but then since he also committed suicide, we have mixed evidence here. And as a result, Pope Benedict XVI, when he addressed this issue, said that we can't really judge Judas. We have to leave his fate in God's hands and not put ourselves in the place of God in judging him. So I understand the basis for saying that that Judas went to hell, but it doesn't seem to me to be an ironclad case, because there are these mixed indications in the Gospel of Matthew. And so I try to follow Pope Benedict's advice and not conclude one way or another whether Judas is in heaven or hell. That's up to God. I haven't been given the information I would need in order to make that determination. But I do have enough information to make the determination that Judas had free will and that God incorporated Judas's decisions into his plan, and God did not deprive Judas of free will.
And Mary, it's time for the break, so we'll leave it there. I hope that was helpful for you. Thank you very much for the call. More Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
EWTN Global Catholic Network is the largest religious media network in the world. 11 global TV channels, English and Spanish radio networks with over 500 AM and FM radio affiliates, one of the largest Catholic websites in the world, dozens of podcasts every week, social media, electronic and print news services, and EWTN publishing. EWTN is the global Catholic network. For more about EWTN, visit EWTN.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum. Lots of folks on the line, so I'll try to work my way through them with Jimmy here. We'll get as many answered as we can before the hour ends. David in Illinois is next, listening on Catholic.com. David, thanks for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Happy to.
I'll try to make it quick. I'm looking for your interpretation of Matthew 16:16 through 19. Mm-hmm. I'm somewhat familiar with your model of the preceding point, you know, so like 16A, then having 16B and C and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Good.
For me, I struggle with that with the Matthew 16 verse 19 with the I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you release on earth will be released in heaven, basically. Mm-hmm. With the two points of it, it seems to degrade the primacy of Peter there to where it would be, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And then if what that is defined as is the binding and the loosing, then that seems to apply to all the other apostles, and then the keys become less relevant because the keys represent that. Mm-hmm. And then also, I'm wondering how to answer the idea, the word for I will give you. You know, it's one word in the Greek, but that's mm-hmm. the verb future active indicative. And so I'm wondering, it seems like he's not giving him the keys there, that it's a future thing, which leads more credence to it being all the apostles and not primacy of Peter. So I was wondering what your answer would be.
So I would say several things. The first one is, I don't think that the power of the keys is exhausted by the power of binding and loosing. I think if you have the keys, you can bind and loose, but just because you can bind and loose, it doesn't mean you have the keys. And as textual evidence, I would point to two things for that. The first one is that this is an allusion to Isaiah. And in Isaiah, it's a single person that has the keys. This is a symbol of the office of the chief steward of the house of David. And so Jesus is portraying himself, the new David, as establishing a new chief steward. And that's one person, that's Peter. He may give legislative authority, which is what binding and loosing refers to others as well. So it's not just Peter that binds and looses, but it is only Peter that that has the keys. And that's illustrated by the fact, this is the second point, that when Jesus does give the authority to bind and loose to others in Matthew 18, he does not mention the keys. So just taking the text at face value, he gives Peter both the keys and, as part of that, the ability to bind and loose. Later, he gives just the ability to bind and loose to others, but not the keys. You then asked about the future verb tense, and I will give you the power of the I will give you the keys. It's true. In Greek, that is a future tense verb, and one of the difficulties with future tense verbs in Greek is that they can mean this is going to happen, but not yet, but they don't have to mean that. They can also be used to refer to present realities. So it doesn't, to me, make much difference which of those you want to say in this case. I would I personally wouldn't decide between them because I don't think we have grammatical evidence to decide between them or contextual evidence to decide between them. It's possible that Jesus is saying, I'm going to give you this, and he means I'm giving it right now. That's within the range of future tense verbs in Greek. It also could mean at some later point, I'm going to do this. It's kind of tied up with the issue of I'm going to build my church because he uses the future tense there too. And so when does Jesus' church begin? Well, it kind of existed during his, I mean, ekklesia just means assembly. It's the Greek equivalent of kahal in Hebrew. And he already was gathering his church around him. The messianic community began when Jesus was still alive. Now, you might pick a later point and say, okay, Pentecost is really when it began. Or some people would say, at the crucifixion is when it began. It's a little ambiguous which one of these points we want to count as the beginning of the church. And in the same way, I could acknowledge some ambiguity about exactly when Peter acquires the power of the keys. Is it at this moment? Is it at the cross? Is it on Pentecost? But it is while Peter is still alive, because he envisions, as part of using the power of the keys, Jesus envisions Peter as binding on earth, which means it's definitely in Peter's lifetime. And since we only have Jesus giving the power of the keys to Peter, and since that's an allusion to a passage where the keys are the symbol of an office of an individual guy, I would still say the evidence supports the idea that Jesus was commissioning Peter to be his chief steward over his household, the church, the same way the Davidic monarchs had a chief steward over their royal palace.
And David, I'm going to leave it there because there's still a whole bunch that we'd like to get to before the top of the hour. So I hope that was helpful. I'm going to go to an anonymous caller listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Anonymous, are you there with us?
Yes. Thank you. My question is this. During the Mass, the priest sometimes asks the congregation to extend their right arm toward a person or persons to whom he wishes to bless. This usually happens during a baptism in the middle of Mass. It also happens sometimes after communion and prior to the dismissal, usually in those cases for birthdays, anniversaries, upcoming surgeries, etc. So this practice makes me a little bit uncomfortable because it doesn't seem licit, but also because my family sees that I'm not participating physically. I'm praying, you know, in my head, but I'm not lifting my arm. So I'd like to know, number one, am I overreacting or being overly sensitive? And number two, if I'm not, maybe how can I explain this to my family and maybe even in a charitable way to the priest? And any references to teaching documents on the subject would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay. So I sympathize with your situation. This is an example of something that the legislator, meaning the Pope, did not envision. And so this custom of having the laity extend their hands to associate themselves with the blessing a priest is giving is something that's not found in the church's liturgical law. It's therefore, to use a fancy Latin word, a Latin phrase, praeter legem. It is apart from the law. It is not required by the law. It also is not explicitly condemned in the law. It's just apart from the law. It's this thing that some priests have started doing because they think it's a good idea, even though it's not in the church's liturgical rites. Well, the Code of Canon Law says that no one is to add, remove, or modify anything in the church's liturgical books. And at least on its face, that would indicate that priests should not be doing this because this would be an addition to the liturgical books, including the Book of Blessings. So there's a case to be made that this should not be done. At the same time, it's a fairly minor matter, and it's minor enough that at least thus far, I am not aware of the Holy See ever having addressed it. And so even though it's apart from the law, it doesn't mean they want to make a big deal out of it. So if you want to talk to your priest about it, I would just say, hey, this is something that is not spelled out in the law. And the Code of Canon Law says that no one is to add, remove, or modify anything in the church's liturgical books. So I don't feel I can participate, and it's causing me to be in an awkward situation with my family, and I just wanted to let you know that. And I don't know that I would, because of how minor it is, I don't know that I would specifically ask him to stop doing it, but certainly letting him know about your uncomfortable situation is a legitimate thing to do.
Anonymous, I'm going to leave that there. As you've heard, I got a lot of folks still to get to.
Also, I would say the same thing to your family and just say, this is apart from the law. There's at least a case to be made that it shouldn't happen, and I don't feel comfortable doing it, so that's why I'm not doing it.
Thanks, Anonymous. We're going to Boca Raton, Florida now. Luke in Boca Raton listening on EWTN Radio. Go ahead, Luke, with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, I just have a quick question around receiving the Eucharist orally. Is it only to be received orally from ordained hands, meaning a priest and an ordained deacon, or is it only through the priest?
No, the church's law authorizes the priest and the deacon and the acolyte as ordinary, if it's an instituted acolyte, as and even lay people in some cases as ministers of Holy Communion, and therefore it is legitimate to receive communion from the person that's distributing it at Mass, whether that person is a priest or a deacon or a bishop or an acolyte or somebody else. As long as they've been authorized to distribute communion, you can receive from them.
Yeah, but my question, I guess maybe I need to be more specific, is to receive it via your mouth, not your hands. I get your hands, you can receive it as long
as... Yeah, no, this is not a distinction that is made in the law. It's always okay to receive on the tongue, or orally, as you put it. And where it's permitted, it's also permitted to receive in the hand. And there is no restriction in the law about these people get to do it one way and these other people get to do it another way. So whoever is distributing it, if they're offering communion on the tongue, which isn't always the case because of COVID, but if they're offering communion from the tongue, you can receive it from whoever is offering it in church.
Luke, I'm going to leave it there because I do want to try to get everybody on. Ashley in the Dallas-Fort Worth area listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network app. Could you be kind of quick with your question, Ashley? Then we'll get you an answer.
Sure. I've been doing a lot of research about farming lately, mm-hmm. and I was wondering what the Catholic Church believes about farming, and especially about industrialized farming.
Well, the Catholic Church believes that farming is a practice that, you know, makes food for people, and we need to make enough food for people to keep them alive. And the only way to do that with a population of 7 billion on the earth is with farming. You know, we can't hunter-gather our way enough to feed 7 billion people. So in general, the Catholic Church is supportive of farming, but that doesn't mean it's supportive of every possible way of that farming can be conducted. If you look in the Catechism and its discussion of animals, it acknowledges that animals should be treated with compassion and you know, should not be subject to deliberate, unnecessary cruelty. It can be legitimate to use animals like for medical testing and to serve human needs, but we want to be as compassionate and humane in our treatment of animals as possible. And so there can be situations where it's at least arguable that a particular version of farming is cruel enough to animals that we should find an alternative to doing it that way. We should do it some other way. And it's a complex calculation and ultimately a judgment call what those situations are, because it depends, for example, on how many people you need to feed. You know, there might be situations where the need for food is so great that it justifies some additional restrictions or some additional suffering on the part of animals in order to feed the humans that need to be fed.
Ashley, thank you. You were quick with your question, and I appreciate the opportunity to let Jimmy answer. Jimmy Akin, thank you for two great hours.
Hey, my pleasure, Cy Kellett.
And tomorrow, once again, on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you're going to talk about shadow people.
Indeed.
All right. Well, that does it for us. Well, tomorrow, we got Steve Weidenkopf and Simone Rizkala, who will be a speaker at our conference this year. Haven't seen Steve in a while. Looking forward to talking about the Crusades with him. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.